Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, education, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and today in the show, we're talking suicide prevention and awareness. It's about suicide among our youth. Park City School District has initiated a major campaign to bring awareness to suicide, and we'll be joined by school counselor Sam Walsh and Willow Amendola.
Good morning, Lynn, and I'm Tim Henney, and next we'll talk about gender reassignment with internationally acclaimed film critic Molly Haskell, whose brother underwent reassignment at age 60. It's her new book, My Brother, My Sister, A Story of Transformation.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Enjoy the fall colors at the Utah Olympic Park this autumn. From now through October 27th, activities including zip lines, alpine slide, adventure ropes courses, and scenic chairlift rides are available weekends only from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. The park will also be open October 17th through the 20th for the UEA fall break. Details and ticket prices are available at theutaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is the only in-town private country club just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, suicide is the third leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds nationally, and in Utah, it's the second leading cause. Suicide does not just happen. Studies show that at least 90% of teens who kill themselves have some type of former mental health problem, such as depression, anxiety, drug or alcohol abuse, or even just a behavior problem. They may also have problems at school or with friends and family or a combination of all these things. Well, coming up in the next two Mondays in the Park City School District are suicide awareness seminars that will answer questions we have or should have about suicide. And now joining us in the studio are Sam Walsh, intervention specialist at Park City High School, and Willow Amendola, counselor at Ecker Hill Middle School. I believe you're still at Ecker Hill, right, Willow?
Yes,
I am. Okay, good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So the second leading cause of death among teens in Utah, I mean, that is a statistic that is so staggering and frightening. I mean, it's almost an epidemic.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, in recent years, Utah has leaded the nation with suicides in our state. And if you look at the statistics from 2011, we had 402 Utahns take their life, and that was 2011. And I actually just got the new data from the state a couple of weeks ago. That rate has gone up to 650. So we've seen an increase of 152 completed suicides in the last year and a half. So it really is an epidemic here in Utah.
Wait, is that number, Sam, is that, it's not teen suicide, it's
no,
overall.
No, that's overall okay. Teens. Yeah. And of those overall numbers, about 4% of those numbers are from youth ages 10 to 17. And again, that 4% is old data from 2 years ago before we had that increase. So I would suspect that that number is now higher.
Okay. So I know that every time there is a teen suicide in the state, it gets a tremendous amount of media coverage, and I know you talk about it in the schools. I recall last year and somewhere in the North Salt Lake area, mm-hmm. A junior high school boy on a bridge killed himself.
Absolutely.
And so I just want to know, you know, how you address it to kids, and what are some of the topics that come up?
Well, I know, and Willow can chime in on this as well. At the high school, we try to be proactive. We go into the 10th grade classes every year and do curriculum around depression, suicide. And I'm so glad in your intro, you said oftentimes it has to do with a mental health issue. And that's what we're trying to get the word out to our students here, that kids that have mental health issues are at extremely high risk for, you know, feeling hopeless and sad and wishing that, you know, they weren't around anymore. So we do some education with the kids. Obviously, as counselors, we meet one-on-one with students that are at risk. We do a lot to encourage peer support in our schools so that friends are reporting suicide risks either that they see on Facebook or Twitter or coming forward to access help from the school counselor. So I'm really proud of our students here in Park City because in the history of Park City, we've never actually had a completed suicide of a current student. So, and I attribute that to our excellent community and our students coming forward and saying, hey, Miss Amendola, or hey, Miss Walsh, I'm worried about my friend.
Yeah, we have a great anonymous reporting system that we start, you know, educating the students about in elementary school and really promote in sixth grade called Friends on the Watch. And what we try to tell the kids is they're the eyes and the ears of the school. You know, they know what's going on online, in the hallways, out in the community, and we really encourage them to report what's going on if they're uncomfortable, and we encourage the parents as well. You know, if you see something or you hear something that you're not comfortable with, fill out this incident report form. It's completely anonymous, and let us know what's going on so that we can address it and, you know, figure out what's going on and support these students.
And how many of those reports do you see during a normal school year? And does this extend beyond the school year and kind of encompass the entire calendar year?
It can, absolutely. And just at the high school level, I probably deal with one to two cases a week of students that are feeling suicidal. I don't know.
And are these students that come to you themselves, or are these students that are sort of, you're led to them through this?
Some students come to me. Sometimes parents will call. But a lot of times we have other teens, because we work hard to educate them. They'll come in and say, hey, I'm worried about this kid. Don't tell them I came in. Or they actually bring the friend down and say, you need to talk to Ms. Walsh. So it's all about kind of building that safe community where kids, a lot of times they come in my office and say, I know this person's going to hate me, or they're never going to talk to me. And I always let them know, but you're saving their life. You're doing the right thing. And in my experience in the last 6 years, I don't think I've had another student really hate another student for intervening, because what we know about kids that are suicidal and suffering is they want someone to ask. They want you to say, are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you okay? Let's get you some help. Let's keep you safe. You know, I care about you.
What's the number one cause of death among teens? Is it car accidents?
Car accidents.
Okay.
Which is the number one across the whole nation. So we're on par with the nation with that. It's just that in Utah, like I said, our rates across the board for all age ranges tend to be higher.
Is there any speculation on why that is?
You know, it's an interesting question. I went to a depression conference in Salt Lake City 2 years ago. And there was a nutritionist from the University of Utah that shared an article about there's a possible link of individuals living at higher altitudes suffering higher rates of depression. We don't know why that is, but she kind of was looking at a whole nutritional piece that people that live at higher altitude need more water than people living at sea level, that our bodies aren't necessarily getting all the nutrients we need. But there is some link to higher altitudes and higher suicide rates. So I thought that was really interesting, especially living in Park City. But other than that, I haven't seen anything else about possible links.
That sounds a little far-reaching to me, but it is interesting that there is that link.
Well, and then there's the opposite argument, because you know, at 4,500 feet or whatever it is down in Salt Lake, you might have a higher rate. And then yet here in Park City, we've had no suicides, and we're at a higher elevation. You know,
sure. Absolutely.
So wondering, Willow, you work at the middle school at Ecker Hill, where the kids, the student population there are about, 11 and 12? And what kinds of mental health issues arise then, and what kinds of things do kids or friends report? What are they saying? You know, my friend said what?
You know, at this age, we start, the students are so uncomfortable in their skin to begin with, just with adolescent development, but we do start seeing quite a bit of anxiety, creeping in, a little bit of depression. You know, we do start dealing with students cutting at that age, and it's, you know, a lot of the same issues that you see at the high school. It's just I think children, unfortunately, in this day and age, in this generation of students, are exposed a lot more than we ever were. I think social media has, you know, and just media in general, they have so many more things coming at them so much quicker than we ever did. And there's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm.
I saw a recent study that looked at Facebook, and it said that people who are on Facebook tend to be less happy than those who don't use Facebook because they're constantly comparing their social mm-hmm. status, their mm-hmm. social activity, their self-esteem to everybody else's out there. And of course, everybody else is just posting their best case yeah. avatar almost. Right. And so if you are prone to depression or you are in a state of stress or social anxiety, it only compounds that. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that sort of thing with
Absolutely.
These kids?
Absolutely. And I actually read that same study and I found it really fascinating because it said as long as you go on and you're off in 20 minutes, like you're posting pictures, you're connecting with people that you can't see, maybe out of state, that you're fine. But for 20 minutes or more, it starts having impact on your mental health. And I think you're exactly right. There's a lot of comparison going on out there on Facebook. I know that we've had situations over the last few years at the high school with kids putting pictures up on Facebook, who's prettier, who's cooler, who's smarter. And really, if you open People magazine, it's exactly what adults are seeing, who mm-hmm. wore it better. But kids are pinning themselves up against each other. Sometimes it starts out as innocent and then it turns into bullying or fighting. And I think it really does have an impact on young developing brains that are, like Willa said, they're still trying to find that comfort level in their skin, even at the high school level.
Well, and I'm curious as to, you know, we've used this term mental health issues a number mm-hmm. of times. And aren't all adolescents to some degree or another mentally unstable?
Well, I don't know about mentally unstable, but what I talk to the high schoolers about in the health classes is there's two types of depression. There's situational depression due to day-to-day issues that come up in life. And unfortunately, in the day-to-day life of a teenager, there are a lot of things that can cause situational depression. You know, drama among friends, bullying, parental pressure, you know, not performing how you'd like to in sports or at school. So in their day-to-day life, I think that's what's make some parents think my teenager is going through so much. Is this normal? Yes, it is normal. However, some students actually have a clinical form of depression that isn't brought on by some of those difficult situations. And I think when you're looking at suicide, it's the perfect storm of somebody dealing with a mental health issue that has some of those normal tough things happen in teenage years, and they don't have the coping skills to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. So I think that is a really, really good point. I think as adults, we're able to see when depression is episodic, and we know this too shall pass, yeah. right? And we can say that to ourselves, but kids don't, like, they're not cognitively developed enough to know that. And also, when you were talking about People magazine, I mean, I know enough mm-hmm. as an adult that for me to stand, you know, beyond in the grocery store line and look at People magazine is not a good thing, not a good use of time. But kids don't know that, yeah. and they can't reason those things because they're developing their emotional, you know, sort of whereabouts.
Absolutely. I think it's just added a whole new parental responsibility for all of us out there about monitoring social media. And it's so hard to do, especially, you know, I have young kids that play games on the computer, especially when they're quiet and they seem like they're being well-behaved. But if you're not really monitoring what they're doing on Facebook or what games they're playing, there could be a whole world of, you know, unhappiness going on with them that we never hear about.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when somebody alerts you? You've been alerted. You have a discussion. Mm-hmm. You find out that it's either situational or clinical or a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. What do you do next with that yeah. child?
Well, I think the most important thing is to establish a relationship and a rapport with that student. Let them know that, you know, that you care about them. You want them to be safe. This is one of those situations for us counselors that we have to break confidentiality with a student and inform their parents. Anytime a student says they're suicidal, or maybe the friends come forward, but the student doesn't confirm it, we still have to, by law, let the parent know, because ultimately that's the parent's right to know to keep their child safe. So I think the most important thing we do is to include the family, but also to let that child know that people care about them.
Now you're intervening in a crisis moment. Mm-hmm. And can you track that crisis moment back to the root cause of what's going on? And you just said you bring the family in. What if the family is so dysfunctional that this is part of the reason for the depression and a possible agent or catalyst for suicide?
Absolutely. Well, that's the last thing we do that's also very important, is to make appropriate referrals. And that can look like a lot of different things. We do have students that are actively suicidal in that moment that we might be meeting with the student. And sometimes we have to get the county evaluator to come from the hospital or Valley Mental Health to do an on-site assessment that might require hospitalization or a safety plan where the child can return home to a safe situation. But obviously, you know, that's kind of what we do as counselors, is kind of look at the family picture and the community supports and figure out who's the best person to help keep that child safe in a safety plan situation, and making sure that student has follow-up services to take care of their mental health. And if we feel as counselors that a child has unmet mental health needs, that might necessitate a referral to the Division of Child and Family Services, because obviously children can't make their own medical decisions till they're 18. So we're there to kind of make sure that they're getting the care they need, and if not, we have to take those appropriate steps.
Okay. I was wondering, Willa, when, we talked about teens, you know, they're in this hormonal stage of life. And we actually interviewed someone on this show who wrote a book called Yes, Your Teen is Crazy. And they were really talking about teenagers go through a state of literal insanity in a sense, because they have these hormones going on that they cannot reason. So, to a certain degree, as parents, we go, well, you know, I mean, like, I know I have boys, and so I know they had to detach, you know, from their mama. So I know that there's this sullen thing that goes on with teenagers. You know, some say teenage boys more than girls. You know, they don't talk. Are there certain trigger words or certain simple signs that, as parents, we just look at that sign or hear that word and we know there's a problem?
You know, it's kind of interesting you bring that up. We have some great resources, at least at our office, that we give to parents that address the adolescent development and some of those issues, like the narcissism, where their perception is their reality, that if one person says something about them, their perception is that everyone is saying it about them. And that, like you said, everyone, you know, your teen is crazy. But there are, you know, there are definitely certain things. I think parents, you know your child well enough, and I don't think there are certain trigger words, but every parent knows their child well enough to know when that red flag is going up, that maybe you need someone to step in and get some help. We have a revolving door of parents who come in there that kind of question, like, all right, I don't think this is normal, you know, and I love it when the parents do come in and ask for resources, and, you know, and they'll say, okay, is this what everyone else's child is doing? Is this normal for this age? Is this normal for maybe what the other kids in Park City are doing? Because I think sometimes it's hard, too, as a parent to say, well, all the other kids are going out and doing this tonight. Should I be doing it because everyone else is doing it? You know, and I think as parents, you need to take a look at, if you have that red flag and you have that uncomfortable feeling, and like you said, you know, is there a certain key word or something? If you're uncomfortable, ask for help. I mean, that's what we're there for.
Absolutely. And I'm always telling parents this, because of course, when it's happening to you and your family with your kid, it feels like out of the ordinary, or, you know, defiance is part of testing boundaries. And like you said, your boy's pushing away. That is a normal part of teen development, but it hurts and it feels like there's a problem. So I'm always reminding parents, your child's brain is not fully developed till they're 24. Mm-hmm. So they're supposed to make bad decisions, and nobody wants to hear that. I don't want my kids to make bad decisions. We're there to guide them through those bad decisions. But it's normal for teens to test or to go through, you know, trying out different things, or to be moody and pushing away because they're trying to find who they are in the world and how they fit in. So I think it's, like Willow said, I think it's always good to ask if you feel uncomfortable or you start to see a change in behavior.
That's a tough one.
It's good to reach out.
That's a very tough one, because, you know, you're surrounded by people As a parent, you'll get this, well, they're kids, they're adolescents, mm-hmm. they'll grow out of it. So that's always going to be the counter argument.
Yeah.
If you give it time, this too shall pass,
right.
is what you're dealing with.
Right.
And then you have this pop culture phenomenon that is inundating everybody, mm-hmm. you know, adults and kids, and it's, you know, it's constantly there. So that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Knowing when your child is on the edge of the rabbit hole and about to fall down is
absolutely
a tough one.
Absolutely. And that's going to be really one of the major purposes of going out and doing these parent seminars is to educate parents in our community about what the warning signs are. So if you're a parent out there listening and you're concerned about your child, we can talk about what some of those warning signs are.
Yeah.
Just like we talked about before, changes in behavior, changes in appearance, maybe not taking care of themselves. And here's the funny teen one, feeling sad, depressed, or cranky, feeling defiant to a degree, that can be normal. But if it's going on for a long period of time and it's really a stark change in behavior, it could be a sign. And all of these things are signs of depression or anxiety. Sleeping too little or too much. A big one I see for teens, withdrawing or isolating from friends. It is normal for teens to want to be with their friends all the time. If they were very social and suddenly are staying in the room, not coming out, that could be a big warning sign. Just having mood swings, having rage. I think sometimes depression gets missed in people that are agitated and rageful, but that's how depression shows up in some individuals. Substance abuse, another confusing one, because a normal part of growing up is experimenting. But increasing use of drugs or alcohol can be a warning sign. Making threats, that's another big question I get from parents. They're saying they're going to do it, but I think they're just getting attention. But making threats have to be taken seriously, because none of us actually know if a person is truly suicidal or going to take that irreversible act. So those statements need to be taken very seriously, whether they're direct or indirect. And then looking for a way to kill oneself, looking online, reading books, talking about kind of very dark situations, maybe about, you know, friends at school or things that they're seeing. And then a suicide note or plans. Willow and I attended a National School Safety Conference this summer in Las Vegas for the week, and they talked about the importance of school-aged children for parents and teachers reading what your kids write for school.
And their artwork.
That there was never a case of a serious incident, whether it was a suicide or a school shooter situation, where a student wasn't communicating on Facebook, telling people they want to hurt themselves or others, or writing in their English papers, for instance, very dark, disturbing content. So as a community, that's something we all need to be monitoring and taking really seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the schedule for the upcoming seminars. And these, you say, are just for parents. They're not, the kids are getting it at school. These evening seminars are for parents.
Yes. It's actually these, there's going to be a series, and part of this comes out of House Bill 298 requiring school districts to provide parent seminars. They are going to be appropriate for high schoolers and for parents, because high schoolers that are at a higher level of brain development, they too can watch for warning signs and refer. So we want all the high schoolers out there to come. We've invited parents from Wyloming and Park City Day School, but anyone in the community is welcome to come out. So age 14 and above and parents, we just really want to get the word out about the warning signs and what you can do to help your kid here in Park City.
And we'll have a series of different things coming up. We'll do the suicide prevention. We have internet safety coming up. We definitely are always proactive on the bullying, cyberbullying. We're going to bring in Girl Rising October mm-hmm. 11th. And so just a lot of things.
Yeah. Okay. So this coming Monday, the first one is at Ecker Hill?
The Eccles Center.
Or at the Eccles Center.
Yes.
Okay. And the time on that is
6 to 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, that's this coming Monday, September 23rd at Park City High School's Eccles Center, 6 to 8 p.m. And the following Monday, a week later, September 30th at Ecker Hill Middle School from 6 to 8 p.m. I assume that's just in the auditorium as well.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Sam Walsh, Willow Amendola, thanks so much for your time today. And we'll talk to you again next week and get a little more update.
Okay.
We'll talk about We'll get an update maybe next week on how the first one went.
Absolutely.
So, okay.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in today. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back with film critic Molly Haskell talking about the gender reassignment of her brother from Chivy to Ellen. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
From New Orleans, it's American Roots and Friends.
Hi, I'm Sharon Jones.
And Bosco Man.
Hey there, this is John Doe.
Hello, folks, this is Jerry Lee Lewis.
Hey, Will, it's Trombone Shaw.
This is Toots from 2 Centimeters.
This is Earl Scruggs.
This is Fats Domino.
This is Hugh Masekela.
I'm Elvis Costello.
And I'm Alan Toussaint.
Saying stick with Nick on American Roots.
If you know what I'm saying.
Sunday mornings at 11 on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time InstaCare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza InstaCare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, internationally acclaimed film critic Molly Haskell was no stranger to alternative views and felt her outlook was open. But when her 60-year-old brother Chivy came to her house to tell her that he would begin the process of gender reassignment, he would become a woman named Ellen. She was blindsided. Now, years later, Ellen is Molly's sister. And sometimes Molly still slips up calling Ellen her brother. I mean, sister. But it's all okay. And finally, she was given permission to write about it. My Brother, My Sister, The Story of Transformation is her new book. And Molly is joining us to talk about how she sorted it all out for herself. And now she hopes to do so for an entire community. Molly Haskell, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
So, Molly, I want to just start with this. Your brother, Chivy comes to you one day to tell you how he's going to begin the process of gender reassignment. Can you just tell us the story of that?
Well, he came up to New York to visit and didn't bring his wife, which was a sort of the first sign of something amiss, and sat us down and told us that he'd had this thing called gender dysphoria, and for as long as he could remember, he felt he should have been a woman. And both of us were just flabbergasted because this was a guy who was all guy, and he'd had two wonderful marriages, and he was just, I mean, I don't want to say he was a straight arrow because that sounds sort of negative, but he was a straight arrow, but a sort of idiosyncratic one. But it was just unimaginable. Plus, I just didn't understand the whole, I mean, I thought, I'd read about it, of course. I've always been interested in film and gender roles, but this is something that is just beyond anything. It's just so difficult to understand because it strikes at the core of who and what we think we are and what we think is permanent, our sex. So I had a ton of questions, one of which was, why now at this late date? And he said that, unlike, it's not, as you know, not about sex, it's about identity. And so the urge actually gets stronger rather than weaker as you go along, because he thought when he married the second time, he was convinced that he could suppress it, and he just couldn't. And now he's finally going to do something about it. And what I came to understand as he went through this process is just how overwhelming the whole thing is. It's hard to know even what word to use to describe it, because you're risking so much. I mean, he was going to hurt people, which was not like him at all. He might lose loved ones. He might lose his place in society, all of these things, and undergo these wretched surgeries and electrolysis and all of this. And then who knew how it would turn out? So there were so many perils and so many frightening aspects to it that I think my reactions just ranged. I was, first of all, just shocked and wondered how he could have endured this for so long, and how I wondered how great had the suffering been. Then where was he going to live, what was he going to do with his life, and how would he turn out? Just questions after question.
It's funny, your affection for your brother, probably contributed to, wanting to take care and being worried for him about just these basic, even just logistical things, really.
Exactly. I mean, where would he live, and would he be persecuted and all of that? And it's dangerous. You know, it's such a threatening thing that it can set people off. It's very threatening to men. I mean, the same kind of people who commit homophobic crimes commit anti-transgender crimes, and they're very unprotected. They're very vulnerable. And, in fact, it's only recently, even though they're part of the LGBT, I think they've lagged behind all the other minorities in getting rights and protection. It just weirds people out, that's all. And I think people have such a hard time with it that they react negatively.
Right.
It's sort of understandable.
Now, I kind of forget the words that you used, but they were very poignant. And it was about that Chivvy wasn't going to change into a woman. He was going to sort of take off this costume that he had been wearing that was a man.
Well, that's right. And, I got, it wasn't my words exactly. It was when they sent the galley of my book to a transsexual to look at to read it. And they had used in the jacket copy, they said that her brother decided to become a woman. And she said, transsexuals don't become women. They already are women. Well, I mean, I think she said it's like gay. You don't become gay. Well, I think the two things are different because you do decide to go through with the thing of becoming a woman. But that is exactly how they feel, that they already are a woman. She had a name and a sort of sense of herself as a woman that was more real to her than the maleness that we all saw. So that there's this complete disconnect between how they see themselves and how we on the outside see them. And what the process is to bring the outside into alignment with the inner self. And that's the part, I think, that's hard to understand, that they really, in some sense, already are this person, this woman.
Molly, I've got a question about terms. I'm a little confused as to transgender, transsexual.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
I think people use them. One of the problems is there's so much fluidity even within the transgender community. First of all, they're transsexuals who don't have surgery but do live as the opposite sex. There's a councilman in New York, Mel Wymore, who calls himself, he's transgender, and he likes to live sometimes as a woman, sometimes as a man. Now, that's not a transsexual at all. That transsexual is definite. It is somebody who does change from one sex to the other, but not necessarily with the surgery. So sometimes they feel like they're just too old. They're not going to bother with it. But I mean, there was this English folk singer, I don't know if who died recently, as Louisa Joe Killen. It'd been Louis Killen, and he died at 79. At 76, when he got a cancer diagnosis, he decided to go ahead and have the surgery and live as a woman. So
wow.
This shows you just how powerful this urge is and how you just don't want to die in the wrong body. But as far as transgender, I use it to cover everything, even female impersonators. Then there are people who the whole range of transgressive, kind of sexually transgressive behavior. That other people use it in a more specific sense, and I think there's a kind of struggle going on about the terms themselves, too.
Molly, I'd like to explore the issue that you brought up earlier of why now. Did it take Chivvy time to kind of come to this point in his life where he had the courage to step fully into Ellen?
I think that was a large part of it, plus the urge itself just took over. I mean, it really is almost, she said after this whole thing was over, and she was talking about the book and what we were writing, and she read the book. I added this because she read the manuscript, and she said, I can't believe I did all that now. And now when I look back, I can't believe I did it. It was like I was possessed. And I think it is, when you read it, you think, how can anyone go through with this? You have to be in a kind of altered state of mind, I think. Mm. So I really do think there's a kind of possession that takes hold, and you are possessed by this fantasy self that is more real than the one that you're exposing to the world.
And what were some of the challenges and obstacles that Chivy faced in making this decision, the societal and familial?
Well, I think the worst thing was telling his wife. I just think, and that, and the strange thing is, this is the kind of denial that you get into. When he told her he was going to go through with it, it was on the eve of the marriage of her daughter, his stepdaughter. And when he read that, even that, because I asked her to talk. She talks a lot in the book about her point of view. And she said, couldn't he have picked a better time? And of course, it was the worst possible time. And when he read that, and he didn't, she read that, Ellen, my sister, as she was then, read that. She didn't ask me to take it out. She said, I've never done anything worse in my life, and I didn't even remember doing it. It's like they get this sort of tunnel. It's the only way they can go through with it, in a way, is to just finally push everything else to one side, because the whole thing is it's just so terrifying on so many levels that at a certain point, it's other people's feelings just have to be cast aside. And then, of course, you resume, and the guilt comes back. All of that comes back. But at that one moment, that's the only way you can go through with it.
And then, Molly, interestingly, his first wife, who he separated from, divorced, you know, earlier in life, was very supportive of the entire process.
She was. And they're very different. They're very different kinds of women. And he and now she adores both of them and is good friends with both. But the first wife, first of all, they were much younger. And she just felt he would still be, if he became a she, it would still be her best friend. And indeed, she was. They are best friends. So somehow she was able to, and then she did remarry, whereas Eleanor, the second wife, they were older. They'd been married for, I don't know, 15 or 20 years. She'd imagined that they're traveling, living out their years together. And suddenly her whole vision of the future was gone and was crushed. And it just, it was like everything came toppling down for her.
Was there any room, or has there been sense, for them to be friends and do the traveling
for
together?
For a while, she couldn't see her. It was too painful, because every time she saw her, she just kept seeing her husband behind Ellen. They couldn't even be together. Then they were selling a house, and she was moving away, and they had to be together. And so they went through all of this. I mean, they had stayed in touch. They would talk on the phone, and Ellen would come by when Eleanor wasn't there and fix things for her. I mean, he is just an incredibly handy, smart person. When neither the wives nor I could get along without her. But then finally the children said, well, please, Mother, you've got to have some kind of reconciliation, because we want her in our lives, and there'll be events that we want her to come to. So she did. But it'd been about a year when they didn't see each other at all. And now they're friends. I think Eleanor still has trouble with her being in public, but they do things together. And I'm afraid that I'm not sure how that's going to go after the book, because she just dreaded the book. And as fair as I've tried to be to her in every way, I think just the book itself, and she's protected. I've changed her name and everything, but I just think it's just very hard on her. So I'm hoping that she can forgive me.
We're speaking with the film critic Molly Haskell, who's written a new book called My Brother, My Sister, the story of a transformation, and that transformation is from Chibi, the brother, to Ellen, the sister. And I just want to say, Molly, you know, we've been talking for 10 minutes, and this whole time I've been thinking, okay, when am I going to start calling this person Ellen and referring to him as her? And so I'm wondering, for you also, was there this time, you know, was there this gradual transition from male to female, or did you just one day wake up and said, okay, you know, now it's Ellen, my sister?
No, the first is, it's gradual, and it's never complete. As you said, most of the time when we've been talking about the past, and he's a he in the past, although there are some transsexuals who refuse to allow the pronoun he to be used. They say they were always female, and they just deny the he side of themselves. Well, Ellen is not that. She acknowledged her male past, and she says she even cherishes it. So in a way, that makes me more comfortable, so that I can still cherish Chibi as well. But I use Ellen, and more and more often, I make the mistake less frequently, and when I do, she's so gracious about it that I don't I mean, I do feel a little bad. And I, well, what I do, what one of the interesting things is I've noticed that I'll be talking to people and I'll say, my brother, I mean, my sister. And they'll say, your brother, I mean, your sister. And it's almost like we have this compost. It's not so much a slip as a new construction that seems to embrace the past and the present. Because the past is the past. 59 years of brother doesn't just evaporate.
Right.
So she's still my brother, and that's okay with her. But more and more, I think it's, as I see, first of all, it's all very organic in a way because she is so comfortable as a woman, and she's handled it so well, and she's so happy. I mean, I knew that the minute she sent me a photograph before I ever saw her, and I could just tell by the picture that she just was just so pleased with herself. She didn't know what to do. And so that in itself is just makes me at ease and makes me happy for her and comfortable. So I do. What I feel is that she is Ellen, but Chibi is in there too, and I'm so sort of relieved that I didn't lose Chibi, and I think she understands that too.
Molly, what Ellen did has you mentioned that Eleanor had this story and attachment to the future of living out her life
yeah.
with Chibi, and then we talked about how Beth embraced the present and the future. So it seems to me that you're. This whole story and what Chibi did is really challenging the concept of attachment to the story that various people and families and society make about the future. So
that's
Beth
right.
embraced it. Beth embraced that possible future. Were there other people who had an easier time embracing the future, like maybe children or younger people? And then were
well,
there other?
Well, that's a really good question because I've been fascinated by certain transsexuals have stayed in their marriages, and I don't know what the sexual component is, but probably just because they really love each other, and the wife, as it's usually the case, has been able to just sort of overcome the obstacle. In fact, sometimes the best friend has the hardest time. A man friend of a man. I think men are just so much more threatened by this, for obvious reasons and understandably, than women are. But I think we do change in marriage, and I think we do have a narrative. We have a myth of our marriage that is a certain way, and that myth has to allow for some fluidity. And the question is whether we can change ourselves. Say the other person does change in this really significant way, can we also change or do whatever we have to do to retain that relationship? And I don't know if I could have done it. I don't know. It's just one of those things you have no idea how you're going to react until it happens. Because I do think the transformation, never meant this when I was started writing the book. It was all about Ellen's transformation, but I can see that I've been transformed by her transformation into someone who is sort of not only accepting but celebrating what she's become. Hmm. So we do this to each other without even, it's a very unconscious process, I think, and that's why we can't really know consciously how it's going to turn out until we live through it.
Molly, another really intriguing theme that you brought up, and I'm going to read a very quick passage, is about this issue of normalcy and how Chibi was viewed as very normal, not somebody who society would view as kind of the profiled person for doing this type of thing.
Right.
And you say it's precisely the spectacle of normal that people changing sex that brings into the open the real fear, not difference, but sameness. The degree to which there is already so dangerously much of the female in the male and vice versa. Can you expand on that a little?
Well, yeah, I think this is one of the reasons I think I've observed that men, my male friends, have a much harder time with this book, and I've already told them you don't have to read it, just look at the pictures. But, I mean, first of all, the mutilation, the castration, obviously, and to lose this the reality and the symbol of sort of your place in the world, your privilege, your superior position, whatever. Then there's a thing of what if the person is someone I could be attracted to? I mean, I think it's one thing if you're a fringe, flamboyant performer that's safely distant or something up on the stage, but to be a real attractive woman, what does this say about me? Or then even, is there some part of me that would like to be this woman? I think for a woman, it's so much easier to think, oh, I'd like to to be androgynous and to play the male role, all of that. We've been able to do that safely. It doesn't threaten who we are and our allure for a man. However, any sign of femininity has always been thought fatal. So a man has to guard against this, defend against. He has to prove his, I mean, we don't have to prove, well, we have to, there are all sorts of rules of femininity, but they're not, it's not quite the same as a man having to prove himself as a man all the time. And so this is, I think, very threatening. And the very fact that this defense is so strong suggests that these barriers are sort of more porous than we like to think. And the fear of sort of sliding over. And actually, in studies they do of gender nonconforming children, some of them become gay or lesbian, some become heterosexual, I'm supposed to say normal, and a small fraction become transsexual. So it's a very small fraction of the population. And yet it has a sort of disproportionate power to unsettle, I think. And I think a lot of it is because, I mean, Christopher Hitchens in his memoir talks about, I've always wondered what it would be like, and he's more candid, I think, than most, to be a woman. And then he talked about the myth of Tiresias, who was for a while a woman but then decided to go back to being a man. He said, well, I'd always want to go back to being a man. But I think we do. Even the way when I wrote about movies, I think the whole thing is we get to identify with both sexes in movies, and people always emphasizing, and I did too early on, that women were the objects and men were the subjects, and there was this strict dividing line between the way a woman is portrayed and what we identify, you know, the whole identification process. But I came to realize that it's far more complicated than that, that one of the great things about movies is that women get to identify with the action hero and men with the sort of, with the beautiful woman. So there's a lot of that byplay or back and forth, sexual back and forth, that is it in all great art, in Shakespeare and all great art, but that we erected a lot of codes sort of to keep safely divided in life.
Molly, I'm wondering, as you're talking here, it's making me wonder if Ellen always, you know, was a woman, even though Chivy also embraced being a male. You know, there are just these certain things that signal maleness and femaleness. And, you know, maybe they're stereotypes, but, you know, it's back to the whole thing of, you know, women don't want the problem solved. They just want you to listen. You know, were there things that evolved with Ellen that you never saw before with, you know, with your brother Chivy?
Well, no, I think more what it was when I look back, they weren't clues so much as things that took on new meaning once she emerged. Things like, we used to have this argument all the time about who had it better, men or women. And I always said, of course, that men did, and it was a man's world and, you know, hierarchy, a patriarchy, all of that. And she always felt the opposite, that women had it better. And she felt that it was because a man had this huge burden, what we've just been talking about, of having to prove himself and had to have ambition. I think there was always something in her, him in her, that it, you know, some of it could have come because our father died at a bad age for both of us, but especially, I think, for a small boy. And there were these two women, my mother and me, surviving. And he felt that he equated ambition with exhausting a man and maybe even killing him. But in any case, he admitted he never had any great ambition, whereas I did. I didn't know what it was for, but I wanted to do something. And there were other things. He always had tremendous empathy. When our mother was sick, he was very unusual in that respect. He just was by her side and he looked after her, and they were living in the same place, but still he just was sort of above and beyond the call of duty. So there were all these qualities already, I think. And in fact, one of his psychologists, he was talking about whether you change physically or psychologically once you start taking the hormones. And the Ellen said, well, I'm this, I'm crying, I'm doing this, I'm that. And the psychologist said, well, you always that way. So I think a lot of the characteristics remain the same, but this is not always true. Other transsexuals change psychologically. Ellen seems to have changed more physically than psychologically. But I think she's some of the, I mean, she's still good at computers and money, thank goodness, but she's also very kind of much more open and candid and just extroverted. I mean, one of the huge ironies of this is I say in the book that mother would have just, I don't know, died of a heart attack when, if she'd found out about something like this. But then when Chivvy became Ellen, she became the kind of child that mother always wanted, which is she plays tennis now, and she's very extroverted and has lots of friends. So, no.
Molly, you've got kind of an amazing position here. You, as an observer and a writer and a critic of the consensual reality and the authorized world, had this opportunity to see a challenge to that, to the authorized world. And as that observer, can you, through your research and what you've learned and what you've gone through and what Ellen has gone through, do you have a sense of the pace of change and what is happening in our society right now with regard to these issues of gender?
Oh, yeah. When I first proposed this book, people weren't interested. They were still repelled by the subject. And in the 6 years when I've been thinking about it, so much has changed. I mean, just more and more cases of transsexualism have come before the public. The public, it's, I mean, has been forced to think about it. Maybe they didn't want to think about it. It was a subject that was, if not repugnant, at least just something you didn't want to think about. It was, for all the reasons we've talked about, too challenging and upsetting and beyond the norm. Now, I think that these cases are coming to the fore. We're seeing it. Orange is the New Black has a transsexual, a wonderful black transsexual character. Bradley Manning is going through the same thing. Am I going to get hormones in prison? So just more and more cases are coming to the point that even if we don't understand it, and that's what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do in a way was sort of de-weird it to make it seem, if not normal, at least within the realm of understanding. It's a human thing. Even if we can't understand it, it's something very real and very powerful and even obsessional. And it challenges not only our sense of fundamental who and what we are as male and female, but even free will. We can't, because I don't see it as a matter of choice. When you see somebody go through this, it just doesn't feel like choice. It feels like something, as Ellen said, she's possessed. And that's disturbing. But that's what it is. And I think, I wonder, I have so many questions about it, and I don't know if, just, you know, where it originates, because there's a lot of debate now about, I mean, they're finding so many things. The brain imaging technology is so much more sophisticated, and there really are lots of different areas of the brain where the genders differ, and this is biological. And now, how does this happen? Does it happen in utero? I mean, I think as we get, I mean, the science doesn't explain everything, but it at least lets us understand. I mean, things like hermaphroditism. I mean, this is almost on a par with that, mm-hmm. but it's a psychological hermaphroditism rather than an anatomical or physical one. So it is fascinating to me that all these worlds are opening up, and we really don't know how to deal with it. We're just catching up, and the language is catching up, and the political activism is catching up, but it still remains a kind of, I think, a fringe consideration, but I hope less so.
Well, Molly, congratulations on getting this book published and like you say, shedding so much light on the subject as you do beautifully in your book. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you for your wonderful questions, actually. It was a great discussion.
Oh, wonderful. The name of the book, My Brother, My Sister, Story of a Transformation. Molly, thank you.
Thank you both.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, a proud supporter of KPCW. We understand the importance of local banking. We offer banking products from checking and savings accounts to business lending. Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch is located at 1225 Deer Valley Drive or online at grandvalleybank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. We want to thank our underwriters.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park Meadows Country Club, Grand Valley Bank, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and Park City Clinic.